Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
State, everybody. Hi, Joe.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm very good. How are you doing?
Great.
It's a gorgeous day today as we're sitting in this nicely air-conditioned studio.
Yes. Sitting beside, he looks like the Great Gatsby.
He does, you know, he puts it to shame. We arrived flustered, sweating.
Yes, he looks like a boy you'd see sort of leaning on a tennis racket on a yacht, yeah. On a yacht in the Mediterranean.
And our guest today just looked like he was born for 20 degrees or whatever.
He came to our wedding in Knockmore GA Club, and he was there with his boyfriend Tiago, you know, and the two of them looked like a pair of sort of playboys that you would see on the Riviera in the middle of these chick. Chick-shirted throngs.
David Goff.
Sipping martinis, shaken, not stirred, as everybody else was drinking pints.
And everyone was going, he's got
to be the most elegant referee in the history of Gaelic football.
David, you're very welcome to Free State.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. You hold your drink better than Joe, you told me.
Yeah, well, I have a gin and tonic and a bit of slimline tonic. It goes down a lot easier and maybe not as many. But I hold them well enough, just enough to get the stories out of him.
Yeah, I think to be fair now, it's high time that David made a public apology for getting me sacked from RTE.
Yeah.
Looking for something before half-time, Kerry, and there's a pullback there. Johnny Cooper's on the ground, he's got a yellow card before, he's got a second one, he's on red and he's off. Dublin are down to 14 after 35 minutes.
If we've got to go back to David Goff, who I am very surprised.
Well, let's look at one of the key moments that he was involved in, because Johnny Cooper and David Clifford had this brilliant battle going on in the full-back, full-forward line.
So you're talking about...
That's probably a yellow, Joe.
I think...
He said one foul before that. So it's a second foul, so you can't...
I agree, that's a yellow.
You can't argue with that.
I have no issue with that. But the penalty was a scandal. It was not a penalty in a million years. This is a free out.
Johnny Cooper received his yellow card.
Well, that was a foul. There's no doubt that was a foul. The penalty was never a penalty. The referee, I think, must clearly have been influenced by the propaganda that's been coming from Kerry.
Yeah, and I think I think David,
this is the time to do it.
It's the right.
I might end
right
up sacked
do,
from the GA after this one.
You might get sacked if you apologise to Joe Brawley.
He still maintains that was a yellow card. Dolly Cooper, I think it's.
Do you want
to take this opportunity finally to apologise?
No, I pass on that one just this again, Joe.
You keep every time you meet. You get this opportunity for the public apology.
Yeah, sacked for getting a yellow card wrong. I mean, honestly,
That was a strange time, a tough time when that was all happening, and you're in the eye of that storm, David. Now, not Joe.
At the time on the pitch or afterwards?
Afterwards.
I suppose we didn't really know much about it because we went off and we celebrated what we thought was a great performance. Others didn't think it was that great, but we had a fantastic evening. And it was just after that, I suppose, the following day that we realised that something was amiss, and the phone was hopping when I switched it back on the next morning. And look at... It was what it was. I made my decision in the heat of battle and made it correctly, unfortunately, for Joe. He wouldn't have known the rules at the time.
See, David's problem is that he's an awkward bastard. And by that I mean that he's got integrity and he's got the stuffing, and he does it honestly as he sees it. And whenever someone doesn't go with the flow, as he doesn't, people are automatically suspicious of them, you know. And I looked at the penalty decision. As soon as it happened, I said, oh, Jesus, they've got to him, the Kerry ones have got to him. But looking at it afterwards, I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, he basically lifted Clifford and set him down in a different position so that he couldn't. It was a definite penalty. Mm. And also the yellow card, I have to give that to you, you know.
So the public apology should be going the other way.
Well, I did. I did. Mm. As you know, I'm a world-class apologizer.
You are, yeah.
Yeah. And David, I think, texted me on the Wednesday board. He says, don't tell me I've got you sacked. But I told Dan this, you know, he's always punctual and always pristine. I mean, I knew you'd be here before we arrived.
Yeah.
But is that something about being a referee today that is more and more overwhelming? Just that sense of people, like it's a kind of a bigger issue even in sport now. The amount of any social media pylons and people coming at things in bad faith and accusing people of all sorts to kind of just muddy the waters. Is that something that is harder and harder to block out when you're refereeing a match?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. That's the horror of social media, that it gives everyone an opportunity to voice their opinion, an opinion that mightn't voice to your face.
Yeah.
And quite often, more often than not, in the run-up to big games, we just have to switch it off. I mean, because it gets to you, you know, and no matter how hard you try not to look at it, someone will tag you in it, or someone will send you a photograph or a screenshot saying, have you seen this, or this was said about you. Mm. You just get rid of it.
Yeah.
It's a huge pressure. I mean, the Ulster final was, you know, capacity crowd, 30,000 people, you know, very warm day, you know, a hugely grinding, competitive game with a wild lot of stuff going on off the ball, illustrating, of course, the impossibility for the modern referee. And it takes someone of David's stature to referee a game like that. I mean, it was very funny during it, you know, because I'm so friendly with David now, I'm associated with all of his bad decisions. You see, that's your fucking man, Brawley. Aye. Look at that, Brawley. Endo Gormley and McCusker, you see, still smarting from the All-Ireland Club final defeat, you see. So any sort of, anyway, controversial, so Gormley and McCusker, you see, shouting over at me, that's your fucking man, Brawley, you see. And then, of course, when we won on penalties, we were sitting afterwards and the boy saying, Jesus, when is this? Just fair play to Goff, he did a great job. isn't it, you know, that it's that sort of difference between the thoroughly forensic job you have to do and then the vast emotions that all the spectators have. And I think he copes with it very, very well. I think it might be, I think that very clear ferociously fair approach you take to games might have something to do with your own development as a young person. It struck me.
Absolutely. It would be something I would have spoken about a number of times when we visit the sports psychologist around my own perceived unhappiness or struggles around fairness and equality in my own life growing up. And I suppose when I look at that in relation to the GA, maybe they're the type of conditions I tried to create on the pitch because they're the type of conditions that I would despise in my own life.
Yeah. We obviously know each other very well, and we had a very, moving day. Donny and Nesbitt sort of cleared out the front snug for us one Saturday morning. And of course, you know, he was there before me. And it was a very moving day, really. And I learned so much about you that I hadn't known. But maybe you'd tell us, maybe you would go back to the beginning and tell us, because I just think it's so delightful. Tell us how your mum and dad met. So that sticks in my mind.
Oh, mum and dad met in Navan on a blind date many, many years ago. Definitely, I'd say in the late 70s. And, to think that dad had a few drinks for courage. And I don't think he knew which one was mum when he walked into the pub.
Did he sit down beside the wrong one?
I'm not sure. The story's so muddled, I've heard it that many times.
Yes, how the course of history would have changed if that...
So he sat down beside the woman he wasn't meant to be going on the blind date.
There was a few friends, like mum is originally from Dublin, but her family home would have originally been with granny down in Navan, and dad's from Slane, so there's a right mix of friends from the area, so they were all congregating together, and I believe they had a great night, and the rest is history.
Yeah, and your mum was Irish hairdresser of the year.
Yeah, something along those lines. Yeah, she was a fantastic hairdresser. She used to work on Fade Street, not too far from where Dylan McGrath has his restaurant and David Marshall's, and she was an apprentice hairdresser at the time, and she had a fantastic piece out in the RDS designing someone's hair and I don't know, all sorts of photography, and ended up in the newspaper.
So maybe that's where you get your sense of style from.
My perfectionism, is it?
Is that where you get that comes from? Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely. They were never let outside the front door for secondary school without the shoes polished and the hair done.
Yeah.
We were known as the Flanders, myself and my brother.
Yeah, you were sort of slouching into school.
Absolutely
like
not.
A down at heel bus conductor.
Not that Colin O'Rourke had let us, but you know.
Yeah. And so your upbringing, you were born really into a very GAA environment. In
there was nothing much else for us in the village, and the family was heavily involved in GAA, uncles, grandfather, and my brother, who's what we call an Irish twin. He's just over 11 months older than me. So dad would take over the football team and we'd be brought all the way from one side of the parish to the other. We're closest to Navan and the pitch is closest to Drogheda. It was a long trek, maybe 9 or 10 miles across the parish to the football field. And I always played up a level, so I was always on the same team as Stephen. And that was the team dad took. And we had great times playing together. Fortunate enough to have played football with my uncle and my brother on the same day in championship, which is a lovely memory. Dad's youngest brother, the three Goffs lining out for the village.
Class. And you played for St. Pat's Navan, obviously, when you went there.
I did, but I wasn't as good as my brother. My brother would have marked Ronan Clark in the Hogan Cup final in 2000 when St. Pat's Navan beat Armagh, St. Pat's Armagh. I was subbed the following year when we beat Jarlath's Tuam in the All-Ireland final down by 6 points and came back to win it. And fantastic achievement. And, you know, even for Colm, the tradition of football that he had set up in the school, and it's still carried through to this day.
And refereeing then, to become, like, it's another, like, you know, to be playing a sport and then to decide, like, I know from even with like my son's, like, you know, 9 year old, he's nine. Like, anyone, anytime it's like you have to referee a game, it's like, oh, Jesus Christ. You know what I mean? Like, this is, you know, it's a thankless task, even with, you know, at that age level, when you're just, you might, even though we don't have referees, like, that's the whole, but if you do it in a kind of mini World Cup or whatever, but why would you decide that this is something when you're enjoying a game to make that leap into something that you know is going to be so demanding and grueling?
Well, it's not a simple answer. I suppose it's a culmination of a couple of things. I'd already started my journey into officiating. I used to travel from St. Patrick's College in Drumcondra out to Leopardstown, just at the back of the race course there. There's a lovely dome for indoor tennis courts. And I had done some tennis umpiring courses when I was in college. And we're sitting in the canteen of St. Pat's College, Drumcondra. The games development officer, a fantastic man called Tom Fitzpatrick, arrived in and threw a whistle at me. There's coming a Munster game out there that needs refereeing. The referee hasn't turned up. There's €40 in it for you. Out you go. And as a student, €40, Tuesday afternoon, nice sunny warm weather for running around for an hour. And it just took off. Tom, at the time, was training the top referees in Croke Park, the Brian Gavins, the Pat McEninies. And he said to me afterwards, "Goffy, this is something you need to do. I'll get you the games." So I used to hop on the bus from Drumcondra down to Fairview Park Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and referee the coming month school games. €120 as a student for 3 days.
Like you were 19 or 20 years of age.
19 or 20 years of age, getting right. That experience.
And did you enjoy it?
I enjoyed getting the money. Yeah. I have to be honest.
You're a mercenary bastard.
It was fantastic. It was kids' games, no problems. Primary school teachers on the line, never issues, fun. What real GA is supposed to be about.
Yeah, and but I suppose, you know, alongside that, you know, there was a private war being waged inside.
Absolutely, and that's the other part of the refereeing story at the outset is the opportunity refereeing gave me to get out of the dressing room and still be involved in Gaelic games.
Yeah, so I think you told me for the first time, you told me that you'd never told anyone this. And this is the great benefit of having seven jars, you know, when you were interviewing someone. But I will never forget your description of your epiphany, you know, and as I recall it, it started with you walking home from school down Bruce Hill, was it, Navan?
That's exactly it. The lovely walk from St. Pat's Navan past the Mercy Convent down to the bus station, and we used to pass by a petrol station every day, and I was doing my junior cert at the time. I'm not sure if it was after, maybe a business studies exam, I chanced upon going in to the shop to pick up, I can't remember, a bottle of water, chocolate. And on the front page of the Daily Star was a photograph of Stephen Gately, who was, after coming out at that time, so long ago, such a huge impression it made on me. I bought it, put it into a plastic folder and brought it home in my backpack to the house. I didn't open it until I had the bedroom door closed behind me that afternoon.
What did it feel like when you... What were you feeling when you saw that?
Strange, because I had never known anyone in my life that had said publicly or privately that they might have had the same feelings that I was feeling. And if you know at that age that you might not be interested in girls, or that you're certainly not and you're interested in men, it can be frightening because you don't understand the feelings. You don't know why you're made like this. And who do you talk to? How do you explore them? How do you come to terms with them? And to see someone coming out so publicly in the Irish media, it's a little bit of hope But still, at the same time, I knew if I never spoke the words, those three words that are so difficult for people to say, I am gay, as long as you never breathe life or voice into them, well, then they're not real.
Is that what you felt? You felt that was your plan of action, to just never say it, never acknowledge it?
No, because I didn't think I was going to fit in, and that is just human nature. Everyone wants to feel part of something. Everyone wants to belong. And as far as I was concerned at the time, 15 years of age, I certainly wasn't going to belong within the family, within the church, which I was still going to at that age. I was reading at Mass at 15 years of age every Sunday morning, within the GA, and I wasn't going to belong possibly within the education system. I wanted to be a primary school teacher, and up until a few years ago, it was illegal.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Let me take you back to, which I think is such a moving image of this. What age were you when you bought the newspaper?
15.
Was that your first newspaper you'd ever bought?
I'd imagine, yes.
I'll just take you back to this boy sitting up on his bed with the door locked in the bedroom, you know, secretively reading this. And, what were you feeling?
It's a huge sense of excitement, almost a thrill inside me that someone else actually could articulate how I was feeling. And that's frightening at 15 years of age, to think that, you know, you don't know anyone to talk to, and to sit and read that, something that's so public, and to see, I suppose, the support there was for Stephen at the time in the media. But Stephen was famous. Stephen was well known. He was well known all around the world. I was just David Goff from Slane.
Can you remember the picture?
I can. Not so much the front page, but the inside
what
page.
What was he wearing?
He was wearing a kilt.
you'd look great in a kilt. Was that the moment when, had you ever thought before, look, you know, I'm different, and
absolutely. There's plenty of times I would have thought, I'm different, that there was just something, you know, there was an attraction to men. No reason, didn't understand why. But there was also still an attraction to girls. I've had girlfriends up until I was 24 years of age.
Yeah, well, just sort of, in a way you were hiding in plain sight.
I was.
With that. But obviously that was a very, I don't want to put words in your mouth, so tell me if this is wrong, but it was a very damaging double life if you were denying your real self. You know, it must have taken a huge sort of psychological toll on you.
It's hard to wear a mask all the time to pretend to not let people see the real you. And it takes a long time to get over that. And certainly there might have been a bit of internal homophobia very much in my early years before I came out and afterwards.
But it must have been, you know, I think you told me that on your first day in the training college, when you went to the training college, you wore your Hogan Cup winning jersey.
That's correct.
And you wore it as a sort of a public statement. Look, lest there be any doubt about this, I'm heterosexual, I'm a GA man.
Absolutely. I knew I was going to fit in. I knew it was a conversation starter. I knew people would think he's played at a fairly high level. It's a key pack sign on the front of the jersey. Hogan Cup winning team 2001. And that was going to be the conversation.
He's one of the tribe.
Absolutely.
And when you talk about the internal homophobia, like what do you mean by that? Like, was there ever any time, did you ever kind of have external homophobia where you again tried to fit in by being homophobic? Or
I think by internal homophobia, I mean that I was the sporty gay. I was the one that played football, played tennis, involved in sport. I wasn't like maybe some of the lads who were a little bit more camp, a little bit more extravagant. The people that I would have perceived at the time that we only saw on television, the Graham Nortons of his time. And that's where the internal homophobia probably came
right,
from.
Yeah.
I mean, I said to you, I don't know if we've talked about this before, obviously, but I said to you, you know, like, did no one... I was so surprised. I said, you know, did no one suspect in college when you showed no interest in girls? And you said, Jesus Christ, I was having fucking sexual relationships with women.
Absolutely.
All over the place. And, I mean, it did sort of, you know, remind me of cases that I used to do when I started off as a barrister. And when... You know, you were going back to sort of 1991, 92. Mm-hmm. And don't forget, I mean, homosexuality was illegal in the North until very recently because of the sort of the ruling governing sort of party's position on that. And, I mean, I can remember defending, you know, they used to have these days in the magistrates' court where you would have 50 men, the majority of them married, who'd been arrested in police operations at public toilets, you know, men living lives of quiet despair and who were married with children, you know. And, I mean, a gay friend of mine, a very good friend of mine, you know, tells me that he's constantly badgered for sex by married men. Mm. I mean...
It's very common. Very, very common. It's tough. It's not
desperate,
for me,
like, isn't it?
But for those people living that lie. I lived it for long enough, and I don't want to think that anyone else would have to live it any longer.
And is that men of, is that young married men? Is that people who still feel that, you know, that there's a way of hiding rather than...
The age is really irrelevant. Yeah. I mean, it's men of every age that just feel that, you know, that society isn't for them if they're of a homosexual persuasion and they're living a double life.
Yeah, I mean, and the detail of, and it is a fascinating life, and maybe someday that you'll get round to writing your memoir. But your first love, of course, was not a man at all.
No, it wasn't. No. on that journey that I used to make in the morning from Navving Shopping Centre up Brews Hill, as I said, past Mercy College, Mercy Secondary School in Navan to St Pat's, I would pass by a girl who'd come in the opposite direction from that boy. And every morning and every afternoon on the way home, we'd pass. Good morning, how are you? I didn't know who she was. We'd smile. And that went on for a very, very long time before I actually had the opportunity of meeting her, getting to know her name, before we were old enough, I suppose, to be going out in 50 or Navan. And when I repeated my leaving cert, I have finally plucked up the courage to invite her to my devs. And we had a fantastic night. And then I moved to Dublin for college and didn't see much of her again until maybe 2012 or 2016 after the wristband in Croke Park, and I'm sitting de-stressing after a game in a panty bar with a friend on a Sunday evening, and I turn down to my right hand side and I see this beautiful figure in the corner, and I look and I say, oh my God, there she is. And I wonder who she's here with, or, you know, what, which one of the gay friends is she out with this evening, or what's going on. And I kind of shied away and I said, God, I don't know if I can go up and say hello to her. And I went to the bar, got another drink. As the evening wore on, I finally plucked up the courage to go and speak to her. Stunning looking girl, absolutely fabulous. And it was the usual meet and greet, and how have you been doing, and, you know, what have you doing? She was an air hostess, and she had heard my story and complimented me on what I was doing within the GA. I looked around and said, who are you here with? And she said, this is my girlfriend.
Yes. You turned her lesbian.
I turned her lesbian.
You turned her lesbian, yeah. Yeah. She possibly turned you gay.
Absolutely. It's one or the other.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.